On this edition for Saturday, April 10th, COVID-19 vaccination efforts expand across the country as infections continue to increase. A recap of week two of the Derek Chauvin trial. And collecting the history and culture of America through public participation. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. Vaccinations against COVID-19 continue at a pace of more than 3 million doses a day, but new infections are rising in some states. In Michigan, state health officials are reporting more than 7,000 new cases each day. That's a 75% increase on average compared to 2 weeks ago. Hospitalizations and deaths are also rising steeply in the state. Federal officials announced yesterday they are rushing additional support for testing and administering vaccines to Michigan, but the state will not receive extra vaccine doses, a request Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer made earlier this week. In California, confirmed infections have fallen since a peak in mid-January, and many restrictions will be eased next week. But in a decision released last night, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a restriction in the state on home-based religious worship. In a 5-4 decision, the court's conservatives ruled that the state's restrictions treated religious gatherings differently than other secular activities like shopping in stores, where members of many different families gather. The U.S. is not alone in experiencing a rise in coronavirus infections. In Iran, officials announced a 10-day lockdown today as a fourth wave of new cases spread following the Persian New Year or Nowruz holiday. Officials blamed the so-called British variant for the spike in cases and ordered the closure of malls, parks, and restaurants. In India, health officials reported a record number of daily coronavirus cases today, and deaths from the virus are at a near 5-month high. A weekend lockdown is underway in the state of Maharashtra, which includes the country's financial capital of Mumbai. Restaurants, malls, and houses of worship are closed. In Myanmar, a monitoring group said that security forces killed more than 80 anti-coup protesters Thursday night and yesterday in a town near the city of Yangon. With communication and internet still cut off in much of the country, there were scenes of security forces patrolling in a residential neighborhood in the town, but no official confirmation of the attack. Today in southern Myanmar, there were more protests against the February 1st military coup. Independent groups say government forces have killed more than 600 people. The military-led government is disputing those numbers and claims 248 protesters have died, along with 16 police officers. Severe storms hit southern states overnight and again this morning with strong winds, heavy rain, and in some parts, extreme hail and tornadoes. Officials in Louisiana said at least one person was killed and seven injured in St. Landry Parish from a possible tornado. More than 100,000 people were without power in parts of Florida, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas this morning. Heavy rains flooded roads and downed trees in Mississippi. And in the coastal city of Orange Beach, Alabama, a storm brought baseball-sized hail. Buckingham Palace announced today a private funeral for England's Prince Philip will be held next Saturday at Windsor Castle. Philip, Queen Elizabeth's husband, died yesterday at age 99. Military units fired 41-round gun salutes at ceremonies across the United Kingdom and on board British Navy ships. Prince Philip served in the Royal Navy during World War II. Today, his eldest son, Charles, the heir to the throne, made a brief statement to the nation.
My dear papa was a very special person who, I think above all else, would have been amazed by the reaction and the touching things that have been said about him. And from that point of view, we are, my family, deeply grateful for all that.
For more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. The second week of the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who is charged with murdering George Floyd, saw more medical experts take the stand for the prosecution. Minnesota Public Radio reporter Brant Williams was in the courtroom, and he joins us again this weekend from Minneapolis. Brant, in these trials, it's normal for us to see paid expert testimony. This week, we saw a couple of big experts for the prosecution. Did any of their testimony stick? And in fact, one of those experts was not paid.
Right. You're talking about Dr. Martin Tobin, who's a pulmonologist, who seemed to really get the attention of the jurors in the courtroom. He seemed very natural at explaining very difficult concepts and technical information and putting it into plain English, so to speak. And there were times during his testimony when he was giving jurors a little lesson on how breathing works in the body and actually physically touching his throat and showing jurors where certain parts of the body are located and how they help you breathe. And there were times when the jurors were actually, according to the pool reporters in the room, were actually following the doctor along. And at one point, defense attorney Eric Nelson kind of, he objected a bit, and there was a brief sidebar, and the judge came back and instructed jurors, look, you don't have to do this. You can if you want to, but you're under no obligation to follow the doctor's directions.
As you are in the courtroom, this is not like a normal trial where reporters have a particular routine that they follow, the type of information that you can grab from the jurors. Tell me a little bit about how this is different.
Sure, in many different ways. Obviously, a high-profile trial like this, you'd have a full gallery of spectators. We don't have that this time. The jurors are sitting in an odd kind of configuration at one side of the room, and they are not within the camera view. So as a pool reporter, one of your duties is to help describe for people who are following the trial but are not in the courtroom to get a sense of how jurors are reacting to what they're hearing. So I was in the courtroom earlier this week, and the first thing I did was, once the jurors came in the room, was to create my own diagram and give them numbers and assign some of their basic demographic characteristics. So I could say, you know, juror number two is a white woman and she's doing this, she's doing that. So that's like the first thing we do, is all the pool reporters really try to give the other reporters a sense of what's happening in the courtroom.
So how do you figure out, for example, if a juror is paying attention when they have a mask over their face?
Right, it is a bit difficult, but as you probably imagine, you have to pay close attention to what they're doing with their eyes. And as I mentioned, one of the jurors, it happens to be juror number two, is very expressive. And she expresses herself with her eyes. She furrows her brows at times, sometimes narrows her gaze. There are certain times when I've seen other jurors as well, maybe as they start to lose a bit of focus at a particular part of testimony, their eyes might start to close a little bit and they'll start to look down. So there are little ways that you can tell how jurors may be taking some of the information.
Brant, what were your expectations going into the courthouse versus how it felt in there?
If you've covered trials before, reporters will know what I mean. There's a type of energy there, especially you may be sitting amongst a gallery and there are, of course, family members of the person who, in a murder case, of the deceased, and you'll have family members and supporters of the person accused of the murder, sitting in a combined space, and you know, there tends to be a hush when, say, the defendant walks in into the courtroom and things start to quiet down, and there are certain testimonies sometimes that gets people to react in the gallery. So that's missing in this case. That's very different. And also you get access to some of those family members in the courtroom. You can go talk to them during a break and go get their reaction to some things. We're not supposed to do that in this case. We're in different territory now.
And what are we expecting this coming week?
So the prosecution is starting to ramp down their case. We're expecting next week that is maybe as early as Monday, they may be even resting their case. They plan to call another medical witness, and we do expect there to be another, what's called a spark of life witness, somebody who's to basically talk about George Floyd as a human being, as a person who lived and had a life and his impact on his family. And so that we expect that to happen at the beginning of next week, and the defense could start their case as early as Tuesday.
Brant Williams of NPR, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
COVID-19 vaccinations are expanding to the point where the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say it's safe for vaccinated people to travel. But so-called vaccine passports for those who've received them are sparking debate over vaccine equity. Many developing countries are still struggling to obtain the vaccine. I spoke with Northwestern University professor Stephen Thrasher, who recently penned an opinion piece for Scientific American. Global vaccine equity is much more than vaccine passports. Stephen, in your recent column for Scientific American, you point out that the idea of vaccine passports inside the United States takes on a different dimension when we think about having vaccine passports to legitimize travel overseas. Why?
Because it's skipping over the issue of vaccine equity, and it's a miracle of modern science and wonderful that about 500 million doses of vaccines have already been administered in the world, but they've primarily gone to the wealthiest countries in the world. And that means that there are about 7 billion people or more who've received no vaccine. And one of the reasons why this has happened is because the wealthy countries are keeping the vaccines inside of their borders. They're protecting intellectual patents. They've blocked efforts at the World Trade Organization to waive the patents to produce the vaccines as quickly as possible around the globe. And so I think that we really need to have a much more global idea of how we're going to be treating this epidemic. These efforts need to be happening across borders and simultaneously. The longer that people remain unvaccinated around the world, the more mutations are going to develop that could or could not, you know, work with the vaccines that we already have.
Even if you were able to vaccinate every American, that would only work if no Americans traveled overseas or nobody ever visited the United States.
Yeah, that's correct. And of course, we live in a very interconnected world. People are coming and going, even with the borders, you know, largely closed. The idea of a vaccine passport does bring up the idea that, you know, something I'm complicit in, that those of us from certain countries, we already have a lot of passport privilege and that we can travel very freely between lots of countries. And so one of the ways I've been thinking about it as this issue came up is there are ways that states giving or not giving vaccines to vulnerable populations will affect their ability potentially to flee if they need to under war or famine, which is something that already happens under passport privilege. Some of us can travel for leisure or fun, while people who are fleeing life-threatening circumstances cannot cross their borders, and this could make it worse.
How do we take steps toward gaining more kind of global equity of vaccine distribution?
Well, nations break contracts all the time. So the idea that these vaccines couldn't, that these patents couldn't be broken, other countries have done it with other diseases, notably Brazil with HIV medications that had tremendous effect for saving people's lives. So that's one option. It's also interesting seeing what other countries are doing. Cuba is in a really interesting place right now where they are in trials for a number of different vaccinations. And if they prove to be effective, they may well give those patents to, or those recipes to other countries to produce themselves. It is really important that that not only the U.S. or others could be exporting drugs, but that we allow countries to be able to make them themselves. So I'm hoping that the production speed will increase globally among different countries and not only be an issue of how much the U.S. is going to choose to give to other countries or not.
It seems that when we really want to, we can, say in the case of polio or malaria, we can beat things back pretty well. So what should we be doing based on all the types of diseases and viruses that we fought as humanity together? What should we be doing to try to get over this crisis?
The history of smallpox is really interesting, which is one of the very, very few viruses that have been eradicated from the face of the earth. And it was eradicated because of extreme cooperation between the United States and the former USSR. These ideologically oppose empires that work together for a common goal. And I think that's a real model of what we need to be doing with the coronavirus. We need to have international cooperation and support to address how to best deal with this pandemic, particularly because it's one that transmits so casually. You don't need a smallpox passport to go between countries because you don't need a vaccine anymore because it's gone. One thing I think we can really learn about what the US has done quite well this year is that it might have been inconceivable 2 years ago to think that there's a health condition that everyone is dealing with at the same time, and everyone will have access to the to what will help it for free. We'll put in the infrastructure to do it. The US has been fantastic at getting needles into arms in the past few months. It's something that's very much within our grasp to do to help other countries be able to do the same thing. And if we did that, then people could move between borders without the fear and anxiety that we have right now about viruses.
Stephen Thrasher of Northwestern University and a columnist for Scientific American. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Founded in 1802, the Library of Congress, or LOC, is one of the world's largest repositories of human history and knowledge, storing tens of millions of items available to the public. Now, a new initiative, backed by a $15 million grant, seeks to expand the National Archive to include diverse experiences and to help better understand America's past. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano spoke with historians, including Carla Hayden, the first woman and first African-American Librarian of Congress, about this project.
Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the papers of Clara Barton and Benjamin Franklin. Those are just a snapshot of the 171 million historical items preserved at the Library of Congress and available for study both online and on site in Washington, D.C.
Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
But there are more stories and more histories of groups that have been underrepresented in American history.
Carla Hayden is the Librarian of Congress and would like to see a change in what resides in the annals of history.
What we'd like to encourage everyone to think about is the fact that they have stories of value.
That is why the LOC is inviting archivists from underrepresented communities of color to add to the National Archive and offer fresh perspectives on the library's existing resources. Announced in January, the multi-year initiative called Of the People, Widening the Path is supported by a $15 million investment from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. The foundation is also a funder of NewsHour.
This grant will allow us to work with communities to think about what will a historian 100 years from now, what do we need to start collecting now to make sure that they get the full story?
Applications are now being accepted for the program's three components: funding community-based documentarians, providing paid internships and fellowships, and finally, investing in a range of digital projects with a focus on Black, Latinx, and Indigenous voices.
We hope that more people will get excited about the fact that they can make history and look at history that we already have collected in a different way, to delve into collections, learn archival methods, and be the future researchers and documentarians.
Guha Shankar, a specialist with the library's American Folklife Center, says this call for new and diverse voices will provide the next generation of archivists with a more complete version of American history.
The way in which historical materials can expand public consciousness of our shared history, I think, is really important. But for specific communities, it means the recuperation of cultural knowledge which was denied them.
He points to the library's Born into Slavery collection, produced in the mid-1930s by the Works Progress Administration's Federal Writers Project. It is the world's largest collection of firsthand accounts, photos, and recordings of formerly enslaved people.
Well, just tell me what your name is.
My name is Fountain Hughes.
Shankar points out that these interviews were not documented by stakeholders within their own communities.
Some field workers were overly zealous in terms of translating the idioms into these very less than accurate ways. So there's a sense that these people really are illiterate in the way in which they're portrayed in the narratives. Then certain narratives don't even bother with trying to transcribe or capture the words of the interviewees, but just goes on and phrases the interview in the words of the interviewer.
Independent historian Sandra Arnold is using the photographs from the Born into Slavery collection as part of a public participation project she's created on Instagram called Sacred to the Memory.
When you read the narratives, you don't get a sense necessarily that they were able to express themselves the way that they wanted. While I was at Brown, actually, as a graduate student, I became aware of the photographs. I fell in love with the photographs, and I thought that the photographs, they spoke more about the individual's experiences in slavery than the typewritten narratives.
Arnold seeks to shed a new light on the lived experiences of the individuals profiled by delving into the collection's 500 photographs.
You see a woman cooking, you see a man possibly fixing his car, standing in front of his car. You see an individual standing on their farm. You see an individual doing things that normal, everyday people did then and now. That humanizes them. Because I think a lot of individuals, unfortunately, who were slaves in our country, they're not humanized. Slavery itself isn't humanized.
Curators at the library would like to see more projects like Arnold's independent Sacred to the Memory.
What we have here is a unique opportunity to explore the historical richness and diversity of, American and public life.
As Librarian of Congress, Carla Hayden sees the Of the People initiative as a continuation of her duty.
The Library of Congress has been since 1802, when the first Librarian of Congress was appointed, responsible and saw as its mission of collecting history and culture of America, of this country. It's the National Library, and it is important for the Library of Congress to continue to collect history. History never stops, so I'm just really carrying on and making sure that we go into the next decades with more voices and more histories being told.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Saturday.
Finally tonight, climate change may be at the root of a growing crisis for French winemakers. Mild winters mean vines are budding earlier, and spring cold snaps are more severe.
This past week, temperatures in the French wine-growing regions, including Chablis, Burgundy, and Bordeaux, dropped into the low 20s. Growers battled the sudden frost with what looked like large candles, hundreds of cans of paraffin lit to warm the fragile vines during the bitter cold nights.
You see all the little buds which are here? You see them here? So the protection we've put last night was efficient because the buds are still there. So that's encouraging for tonight and the night after that because we're still expecting freezing temperatures overnight. Maybe less cold, but we still need to be careful about that.
In vineyards where Chablis grapes were starting to bud, some growers sprayed water over their vines. The ice that forms can actually protect the tiny grapes from freezing. Other vineyard owners installed heaters and wind towers that mix the cold air near the ground with warmer air above.
The harvest is at stake. Over two or three nights and with no harvest, no sales, no wine for consumers, etc. So it would be a big problem for us, for everyone, and the local economy.
French winemakers say spring cold snaps are happening earlier in the year, in April now rather than early May. That means the drop in temperatures can be greater and can do much more damage.
The climate is changing, and wine growing will probably be the cultivation which will be the first to be impacted by climate change.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.